All right, we're ready to resume. And we've been speaking a lot about the procedures that you've followed in hindsight over and changing over time as well. But there were, of course, a number of particularly technical changes in the way you worked as reporters, I understand, over that period from 1960 through to 88. Can you tell me a bit about what and when they were?
Right. Of course, I always worked as a manual shorthand writer. I used Pittman's shorthand. And when I came to the staff, all the reporters were manual Pittman writers, and even all the senior officers except one wrote Pittman shorthand. So it was the dominant means of reporting. The next change in reporting, of course, was the introduction of the steno machine, and particularly when we started an official training program in conjunction with the Canberra College of Advanced Education, which instituted a reporter training course at the CAE, and the primary reporting tool for that course was the steno-type machine, not Pittman shorthand, which for years had been taught in the technical colleges. But people saw the future of reporting in the steno-type machine. So as people graduated from that CAE course onto our training, departmental training scheme, and then they graduated from that to the reporting team, we had steno-type operators working in the chamber. And we recruited at least one, if not more, steno-type operators from other reporting staffs around the country. It wasn't very often that we were able to recruit from other reporting staffs, but I remember at least one occasion when that was the case. So increasingly, the reporting team consisted of steno writers as well as manual shorthand reporters.
Roughly what time were these machines introduced?
My recollection is that they would have come in the 1970s. The first woman appointed to the Commonwealth Hansard staff, of course, was Pat Sales. And she was Pat Finnamore. She was single when she came here. She later married. So she was Pat Finnamore, later Pat Sales. She was a Pittman, manual Pittman writer, but she at one point left the Commonwealth Hansard staff and joined the Commonwealth Court Reporting staff, where she underwent some training in the steno type machine. And I'm pretty sure that would have been in the late 1970s, maybe getting into the 1980s. So I think the late 1970s, early 1980s would be the time when the steno-type machine came in. And basically it is a different type of shorthand. It's an alphabetical code system. But the some of the advantages of it over a typewriter, for instance, are that you can hit more than one key at a time, whereas on a typewriter it's only one key at a time. And of course you can devise shortcuts in the same way as you can with manual shorthand, and that increases the ability to write, or provides the ability to write faster and faster speeds of shorthand. We had one stenotype reporter at one point who was writing at speeds around about 260, 270 words a minute. So that was the next development. And then a later development, which certainly in my time never came into use on the Federal Hansard, was what was known as computer-aided transcription, or CAT. And that used shorthand written with a steno machine, which by a computer program could be converted into written English. And my first experience of that in a what they call real-time situation, that is with a reporter using the steno machine, the computer program being applied to it, and the written English coming up on a screen, was in 1987. So the that was an advance on the use of the steno machine through the 1980s. That system has been used in other reporting staffs, but to my knowledge, it hasn't been used to any large extent in the Commonwealth staff. But I may be wrong, because remember that I left, maybe jumping ahead here, but remember that I left the Commonwealth Hansard staff in 1990. Now, the other aspect of technology, of course, was the introduction of tape recording. I mentioned earlier that when I came, we had two large reel-to-reel tape recorders, which were absolutely user-unfriendly. But progressively, tape recorders became more user-friendly. Whereas at the beginning, it was almost impossible for a reporter to get access to the tape recording, to check anything, or to fill in any gaps because of a fast speaker or anything like that. Progressively, reporters were given access to tape recorders. My early experience of that was that when we went away from Canberra to report parliamentary committees, sometimes, not all that often, we took typists with us and we were able to transcribe on the spot to our typists. But in most instances, that was not feasible or economically possible. So we took small tape recorders with us and we transcribed our shorthand onto tapes while we were away from Canberra. And we sent those tapes back to Canberra where they were transcribed. And by the time we got back from the out of Canberra committee assignment, the transcript would be ready for us to check through and to make any necessary corrections and process the transcript in that way. And then we got to the point where it was possible to provide a small tape recorder to each reporter. And the practice developed of a reporter turning on the tape as he left the office and then went into the chamber. When he came back from the chamber, there was the tape recording to which he could refer, check anything that he wasn't sure about on the spot, or quite often at the end of transcribing, go to the tape and run the tape through, and if he had the time, check most of the transcript against the tape. But to go back over something I said a little while ago, particularly in the Senate, it was much more efficient to use shorthand reporters who were able to do their editing in the course of taking the note or in transcribing. And so the first strike would be a well-edited transcript. Getting somebody to transcribe a tape recording of a speech without doing any editing is a very laborious and, in my opinion, quite inefficient process in many respects, certainly compared with the skill of an efficient reporter editor. And then, of course, the further development was that with the massive expansion of the committee system, the reporting staff was just completely unable to cope with the volume of work. So it became necessary to tape record proceedings of committees. And just mention as a side that very occasionally it was necessary to tape record a sitting of the House. I don't think we ever tape recorded the Senate, but sometimes if the Senate, if the reps sat for, I'll use the word unconscionable lengths of time, it just became too onerous to expect the reporters to stay on duty. And a decision was made to tape record the proceedings, and then at some point later, we reporters had to go and then transcribe the tapes.
You mentioned that the committee work got so heavy that there was simply not, they were unable to get the reporters out, so you tape recorded. Then you'd still have to deal with the transcribing those tapes when they came back to Canberra, when the committee sessions finished. Was that done by the reporters, or did you use sessional keyboard staff who would actually key straight in off the recordings?
The tapes. Yes, the typists did that off those reporters' tapes that were sent back from the committee meetings. And then eventually, of course, we got to the stage where we had typists who were transcribing directly from the tape recordings of committee meetings.
I've heard that, is it true that there was a special separate section of Hansard set up to deal with committee work?
It's not appropriate to call it a special section or a separate section, because at all times we tried to keep it as an integrated operation. But the amount of committee work became so large that it was completely impossible to handle it within this building. And an arrangement was made with the Government Printing Office, which had gone into computerised photo typesetting, and that had left the Government Printing Office with a little bit of excess space, and we were able to arrange to take over a part of the Government Printing Office building. And we had it converted from part of a factory floor into office space, where we had a series of tape transcription booths, a room for transcript editors, and also, because we were into tape recording in a major way, we had technical officers who not only looked after the maintenance of all the tape recording and transcription equipment, but on many occasions supervised the operation of the tape recorders at committee meetings, and they had an area at the within that area of the government printing office where they had a workshop where they were able to do their maintenance work and that sort of thing. And of course, with the development of the Senate Estimates Committees, which were required to be treated almost like a House or a Senate, and the fact that three of them sat concurrently and had transcripts had to be produced preferably overnight, certainly as soon as possible, we had landlines from the committee rooms where the estimates committees were meeting here in Old Parliament House, landlines to our area at the government printing office. And so there were recording booths as well as transcription booths set up where the tapes could be made and allocated to the transcription typists. So it became geographically it was a separate complex. We called it the Tape Transcription Centre, and it had some technical offices. It had transcript editors employed on a permanent basis. They were permanent officers, some of them, but we also employed additional editors on a casual basis. But we had a large group, and I think I'm right in saying that at one point it got up to about 35 casual transcription typists working in that tape transcription centre. So it was a fairly large operation, and it was definitely geographically separate. We had those technical officers there. We also had technical officers here in Parliament House, and they worked together in that group. The transcript editors there did not work on the houses, nor did the casual transcription typists work on the houses. To that extent, they were separate. But what we did was there was always a middle-ranking Hansard officer, usually at the supervisor level, who was put in charge of that operation. And it was done on a rotation basis so that that person would not lose touch with his or her primary job as a Hansard of the Houses reporter or supervisor. They were always supervisors. And I spent quite a bit of time at that Tape Transcription Centre because, and we might talk about this later, I had a lot to do with the introduction of word processing, primarily to that operation at the Tape Transcription Centre. So we wanted it to be part of the Hansard office, but it was physically or geographically separate. We had it partitioned off. There were quite attractive partitions, and it was carpeted. So the people in the rest of the government printing office referred to it as the Hansard Hilton.
when you mentioned there's all this technology involved, what sort of backup was there for? I mean, if there was a recording made in, say, in the chamber in the committee, anything that's got technology involved will sooner or later there will be a breakdown of some sort. What kind of backup systems were there in place?
Well, often there were two tape recorders running on things, when we moved up to the southwest wing, there were two rooms for the technical people. There was a more office type room where the senior technical officer worked, and where any of his administrative work was done. And next door there was a workshop type area, as well as the workshop we had down at the government printing office. And in those rooms up here, there were banks of tape recorders, recording the houses. And I mentioned that the reporters by that stage had their individual tape recorders. So we had these banks of large Tandberg, you know, high quality tape recorders, which were operated by the tech officers.
Served as backup, obviously, in case of a breakdown in the...
Nearly always. The only thing, and I once had this experience, sometimes, particularly during recesses, when a committee met away from Canberra, we would send a Hansard team for that committee, and it would usually consist of a female monitor to identify the speakers, put the voice, do a voiceover to identify the people who were speaking, and because most of the participants were male, it was a good idea to have a female monitor for that voiceover. And if it was a major committee meeting going for, you know, 2 or 3 days or something like that, we would have a technical officer to operate the tape recording, and we would even have a reporter who would be in charge of the operation and would do the liaison with the committee, make sure we got all the documents we needed, all the names of witnesses and all that sort of thing. But occasionally, particularly at a busy time, we might have just a monitor and a reporter, and the reporter would have the job of running the tape machine. And I remember one occasion when I had this job, and somehow or other the tape was twisted, and when it I switched it on, of course it wasn't recording, it was, it'd been twisted, and I for a minute or so I couldn't work out what was going on, because we always tried to listen to the sound off the tape rather than the sound from the meeting. And when I wasn't hearing any sound off the tape, I realised I had a problem. So in that case, we had just had to ask the chairman to stop the meeting and ask him, would he mind starting the meeting again? So there were occasions when we had problems, but generally, because we had some pretty good quality technical people, and we had nearly always had high quality equipment, the systems worked pretty well.
The change over to the Steno machines, and you mentioned the early 70s, by 1988, when we moved from here, what proportion of the Hansard staff would actually be using those, and what proportion would still be using Pitmans?
By 88, up to the new building, probably at that stage about 40%, just as a rough guess, 40% manual shorthand and about 60% Steno machines, I would think.
And you mentioned just a minute ago the example of committees travelling away and they have a small team with them. Would they only send shorthand, Pitman shorthand people, or people bringing their own Steno machine, type machine when they went?
Steno machine, yeah. People would, Steno writers would go on those committee meetings. Yep.
Mm. You've written 2 papers about Hansard, which are in the collection of the Hansard Library. The one called The Hansard Story, and the other one is Notes on Hansard Staff Practice and Procedures. Who asked you to write those papers?
The PPOs here, I think Jenny Morley, would have been the person who asked me to do that. Certainly the Hansard story one, I think, would have been Jenny. And I haven't a clear recollection of that other paper that you've referred to, although I think it might be similar to...
It's a bit more procedural, dealing with the detailed procedures, whereas the other one covers the story of Hansard and its place in how it came to be what it is today. And both papers are very extensively referred to by new people coming into as trainee guides, for example.
I think the one called John Campbell's Notes must have been the first one, and then the second one called the Hansard Story, an expansion of that original one. Mm. And in the past, I have been asked to speak to new volunteer guides. And again, with the intake that's about to be trained this week, I've been asked to speak that group, the new guides. And what I'll be doing and what I have done in the past is based my talk on this document, The Hansard Story, and I'll encourage people to ask questions, to highlight particular things that are of interest to them. And I think it's the policy to give a copy of this document, The Hansard Story, to each new guide.
Are there any points that you, from this paper, that you'd like to sort of specifically draw attention to today?
I brought my copy of that document, and I have a couple of passages marked on it. If you don't mind, I'll just go through that paper and mention a couple of the points as you suggest. First one I've already covered, just to emphasise the point that the Hansard report is not a strictly verbatim report. I've referred to, in that paper, to something we haven't mentioned, and that is that, as far as I can see, and certainly in my experience, the Hansard staff for the Commonwealth Parliament has been in a unique position and a most favourable position, in that they have been allocated a place right in the middle of the chamber. The Hansard reporter and the senior officer sit in the old Parliament House, sat right next to the Leader of the Opposition. So they're right at the centre table, in an ideal position to hear clearly and even to pick up interjections. In the new Parliament House, there's a separate table at the end of the main table in each chamber at which the Hansard staff is seated. And again, that table is right in the middle of each chamber. Again, an ideal situation. Compared with some of the examples of which I'm aware, in Westminster, the Hansard staff are up in a gallery behind the Speaker's chair, in a similar position to the press gallery here in Canberra. In Queensland, where I started off, similar situation, Hansard staff next to the press gallery, behind the Speaker's chair on the higher level. I actually have had a little bit of experience working as a reporter on other Hansard staffs in Australia, mainly the Victorian. And from what I can recall, nowhere is the Hansard staff placed as well They are here in the Commonwealth Parliament, both in the old Parliament House and in the new Parliament House. One thing in this paper that we haven't touched on very much is what I referred to in the paper as extra-chamber reporting. And that, of course, includes committee work, but also work for bodies outside the parliament. So to talk about the parliament and the committees first, I consider myself privileged to have worked on a lot of parliamentary committees. It gave me the opportunity to spend a lot of time around the country to get to places that no way in the world I would have got to in other circumstances. For instance, within the first year or so of my coming, so we're into the early 1960s, the House of Representatives appointed a select committee on voting rights for Aborigines. And in the course of that committee's investigation, it toured all around the country to Aboriginal settlements and missions and various other places, so that within a year or two of my coming here, I went on an extensive tour of Queensland, visiting Aboriginal settlements and missions. And then, not very long after that, another visit that committee made to the Northern Territory. And we went to places such as Papunya. I'm talking about 1962, it would have been, I think. The people at Papunya had only just come in from the Western Desert. And here was a parliamentary committee visiting that settlement. We went to a place called Hooker Creek, which was right out to the west, nearly to the Western Australian border. We went to the main centres, of course. We went over to Bathurst and Melville Island, went to Roper River. It was an absolutely wonderful experience to have the opportunity to visit those places and to experience something that of the situation of Aborigines back in the 1960s. So that's one example of committees that I can remember clearly. And of course, there were many, many committees that met in the capital cities, as well as major, I suppose, some provincial towns, but mainly they met in capital cities. But then another type of extra chamber reporting that we were called upon to do was to report meetings of ministerial councils. And again, this was a really enlightening, and I think I was privileged to be involved in just the reporting side of these some of these councils. The major one that we had to report was the Australian Agricultural Council. In those days, the 60s, the 70s, even into the 80s, this was a major meeting of all the ministers, Commonwealth and state, concerned with primary industries. And it had a permanent secretariat, and prior to each Ministerial Council meeting, there was a meeting of the Standing Committee on Agriculture. And that Standing Committee consisted of the heads, the permanent heads, of all the state and Commonwealth departments of agriculture or primary industry, whatever their various titles were. And we reported the meeting of the Standing Committee, which was unusual, because generally speaking, we reported only meetings of parliamentarians and ministers. But that was an example where we reported the Standing Committee, and those transcripts had to be done on the spot, because the transcript had to be completed and available for the Ministerial Council meeting, which followed within a day or so. The Standing Committee usually met at the end of the week, and the Ministerial meeting was held at the beginning of the next week.
Why was the Hansard staff involved then, when the committees, these councils, had their own secretariats?
Well, it wasn't a secretariat that was capable of providing a full verbatim transcript of the meetings. It was just a small administrative secretariat for it within the Commonwealth Department of Primary Industry.
So you were effectively a Hansard report. Hansard was seconded effectively to carry out this task.
Yes.
For all ministerial council meetings?
No, not all. It was done through the presiding officers. The relevant council would ask the presiding officers to provide the Hansard service for that council. And not all the ministerial councils wanted a Hansard report of their meetings. So, for instance, the Agricultural Council, I can remember going to one of their meetings, which was held in Mount Hagen in New Guinea, which was a fantastic experience for a Queensland boy to be able to go to a place like Mount Hagen. I would have still been probably in the late 20s, I guess, when we went to Mount Hagen. I remember another one of those meetings held in Mackay in Queensland. That was another one. Another similar council, which I think was staffed by the same secretariat, was the Australian Fisheries Council, because that was part of the Commonwealth Department of Primary Industry at that stage. And again, I can remember going to report a meeting of the Fisheries Council in Rabaul. Another fantastic experience.
How come you got to be selected to do this job? There must have been many of you who would have liked to have done.
Well, initially I was single. I married in January 1963. So just for a couple of years, I was single. So it was easy for me to be sent away from Canberra, but I don't know why I was able to go on these jobs, but they were truly wonderful experiences. I should have mentioned one of the most unusual, I suppose, because when I referred to New Guinea, it reminded me of this one. The House of Reps decided to, won't hurt if I say all this. I'm sure nobody will take offence. The House of Reps decided to appoint a committee on aircraft noise, because this was a big issue, particularly around Sydney Airport. But for whatever reason, the committee decided that it would be useful to investigate aircraft noise around Papua New Guinea. And so, and this happened in the case of that Aboriginal Voting Rights Committee and many others, the committee was able to arrange for a defence aircraft to be made available, usually a DC-3, And on this occasion, we picked up the DC-3 in Port Moresby, and we visited just about every major airport around Papua New Guinea. We did the complete tour, the full circle of the major airports around Papua New Guinea. And again, it was just an incredible experience and something that I never thought, you know. Okay, I'm talking about this as though I'm a tourist, but some of it was hard work. Having the opportunity to see these places was just something that I never envisaged that I would ever have.
It wasn't a working holiday.
No, it wasn't. But by the same token, I'm being very frank here now, by the same token, it was often possible to work in a little holiday with some of these committees and councils. For instance, I can remember one occasion when I was able to go to Perth to do a reporting job in Perth. And because there was another one to be held a week or so later, I was given permission to stay in Perth or in Western Australia for I think it was about 10 days or something like that. So I actually flew my wife and our 2 or 3 year old son, two he must have been, over to Perth, and we had a little family holiday in the time in between these two meetings, and spent a bit of time down the in the southwest of Western Australia and catching up with some friends in Perth as well. So that's enough. So I mentioned the committees, the ministerial councils, and the other thing was that from time to time, through the presiding officers, we would be given the job of reporting international conferences. Some examples that I've mentioned in this paper are meetings of the Commonwealth Parliamentary Association, the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization, CETO. On one occasion, we did a job for the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization. One that I haven't mentioned in the paper was a meeting of, as I recall it, what was known as the Five Power Defence Pact. It was to do with the situation in Malaya and Malaysia. And that conference was held here in Canberra. And I remember that we had to have special security clearances for that, as we did for CETO conferences. That's another example of extra chamber reporting. And without going on too long on this, there's another example, and that is that I suppose it's an extension of those ministerial council meetings, but a regular reporting commitment was to report the Premier's conferences, particularly when they were held in the House of Reps chamber. The practice was adopted certainly at one point of having a public session of the Premier's conference in the House of Reps chamber. And then it would be closed off to the press, and we would continue to report the proceedings there. And sometimes the Premier's conference would then adjourn to the Cabinet Room, and again we would report the proceedings of the Premier's conference in the Cabinet Room. But strangely, when it came time to have the meeting of the Loan Council, which was often held in conjunction with the Premier's conference, we were never required to report the proceedings of the Loan Council. Now, don't ask me why, but that's just something that sticks in sticks in my memory. So I've probably gone on a bit about the some of the points in the that document called the Hansard Story.
Well done. I think we would be fair to say, I think we have covered the procedural aspects of work in fairly great detail. And there are a large number of other areas which I'd like to come to, but we've run out of time for today.
We'll close
this session off with this, and then we can come back to it at the next session if there's more to be added to what you've already said on that.
So that's fine.
We'll do that.
Thank you.
Thank you.